As protests continue around the country, we look at what it means to be a white ally.
Learn to trust that black and brown peoples know their reality better than you do.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for June 2nd, we look at the role white people can have in anti-racist activism. Also, how a right-wing conspiracy theorist won a Republican primary race for the U.S. Senate in Oregon.
An easy way to think about QAnon is to sort of think of it as Pizzagate 2 or like Mega Pizzagate, because a lot of the things in QAnon, I think we saw initially with Pizzagate.
And then we hear from a former felon in Florida about what his restored voting rights mean to him.
America is based on second chances.
But our lead story today, after the president's speech in the Rose Garden, how right-wing extremists are playing a role in protests.
Let's get started.
If a city or a state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
As anti-racism protests continue across the country, on Monday, President Trump chose to move the conversation away from police brutality and racism. Instead, he threatened to deploy the military if uprisings in various cities continued.
I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters. But in recent days, our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa, and others.
Earlier in the day, the president had a heated call with governors from across the country, calling many of them weak. Later in the Rose Garden, with tear gas and angry crowds just blocks away, the president expressed a desire to, quote, dominate the protesters.
Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled.
This followed tweets put out by the president in recent days claiming that anarchists and radical left activists were behind most of the damage. Other public officials have used similar messaging even when blaming very different groups. In Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz, as well as the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, initially said that the majority of people arrested in Minneapolis over the weekend came from out of state and indicated that many of those people were white supremacists. But the officials later revealed the data they had been referencing was inaccurate. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today, examining the role of extremists and the increased calls for military action as racial justice protests continue around the country. This is The Takeaway. Tess Owen is a reporter for Vice News covering extremism, and she's with us now. Tess, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Leisha Brooks is the outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Leisha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzia.
So, Leisha, let's start with you. These increased calls for military action from the president of the United States, particularly yesterday, is there a precedent for doing this in this country in regards to racial justice protests?
The move by the president is unprecedented, and it's an alarming development with very significant implications for our civil liberties as U.S. citizens, particularly those of color. This designation of Antifa, or the propensity to identify political groups as domestic terrorist groups, is an unprecedented move by the Trump administration. It further criminalizes people's response to the protest.
Leisha, the president and his attorney general, William Barr, have repeatedly said that it's anarchists and Antifa, as we mentioned, we're going to get a little bit into who they are behind these nationwide demonstrations. Leisha, is there any evidence that suggests that that's true?
Not at all. It's a distraction from the president. He's trying to distract from the very real fact that the terrorists and that their terrorist threat in the U.S. is from the far right. It has been for some time. The Department of Homeland Security made that very clear last year. It's a distraction. He's trying to take away the focus away from the protesters who are protesting peacefully and start a political discussion that attacks Antifa.
We're going to get into a little bit more about who Antifa is and the tone of the protests that we're seeing. But Tess, I want to bring you in here. You've been reporting on several different far right groups that have shown up at some of the recent protests. How big of a presence have far right groups, and even I would suggest even far left groups, had at these demonstrations?
So I have been, you know, there has been evidence of these extremists, these far right extremists actually showing up to the protests. And I'm tracking that, but it's, you know, it's scattered. You might have heard about the so-called Boogaloo Boys, these guys who are wearing Hawaiian shirts and carrying guns. They're sort of these new anti-government extremists, and they are anti-law enforcement. Their approach to law enforcement is rooted in these deadly standoffs between extremists and federal agents like Ruby Ridge or Waco. But they're trying to position themselves as allies of Black Lives Matter, but I'd also caution that they are seeking violent encounters with law enforcement and have the ultimate goal of civil war, and they reject the fact that police violence disproportionately impacts people of color.
So Tess, I'm curious, has the president threatened any white supremacist or extremist groups with those views in the similar way?
Not at all. Not really at all. I mean, but the DHS actually, Politico got hold of a DHS memo that was apparently sent to law enforcement around the country, warning about that, you know, anarchist or militia extremists would try and exploit these protests for their own gain. And that was consistent with what I was seeing and tracking online. You know, white supremacists using the messaging app Telegram, encouraging followers to go to the protests and target non-white protesters or start shooting into the crowds. Politico also mentioned this chatter of armed militia groups talking about storming capitals. Earlier last week, a militia blog proposed that followers set fire to police cars. So, you know, exploiting moments of political uncertainty is certainly not a new tactic for these groups. But, you know, in terms of whether it's just bluster online, you know, it is scattered in terms of their real presence from what I can tell so far.
So just to be clear, and Leisha, I'm wondering here your thoughts, because it sounds like we are hearing that there are both far right and far left presences that could be contributing to some of what we're seeing, both white supremacist groups and anarchist groups. Is that right?
That is correct. If I could add to Tess's reporting, the Southern Poverty Law Center is seeing the same. Some individual members of far-right extremist groups have been seen at these rallies. I think it's important to note that their purpose is to sow chaos and to magnify chaos, right? They want to see societies collapse. So anytime there's an opportunity to exploit that, they'll do that. And so they're slow moving, but they still are involved. The accelerationist movement in particular seek to the collapse of society, and they want to build a fascist white ethno state. So anytime they can exploit the political system, they will do so.
What about the anarchists? What about what the president is calling Antifa? Who are they, and are we seeing their presence here as well, Leisha?
Antifa is a kind of a broad community-based movement that's composed of individuals who are against fascism, who are against racial and economic injustice. Oftentimes, Antifa will show up in support of protests and rallies that are pushing back against anti-Black racism. They are seen as supporters of justice, right? The thing is that President Trump and his allies have long tried to vilify Antifa. And this goes back years, even at the beginning of his administration, when we had demonstrations in California with Milo Yiannopoulos and Richard Spencer. And he would like to paint Antifa as the boogeyman and take attention away from the very real threat from far-right extremists. So this is a distraction, to be clear. There is also no organized effort on the part of Antifa to disrupt peaceful protesters. So I just want to be clear about that fact.
Leisha, the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks extremist groups in the United States. Is Antifa a part of your tracking? And if so, why or why not?
We do not identify Antifa as a hate group. For the Southern Poverty Law Center, our definition of a hate group means that you have to have a belief or philosophy that vilifies an entire group of people based on their identity characteristics. Antifa is a political group, and their beliefs represent, you know, left politics. So they're not attacking a group of people based on who they are, as you see with far-right extremist groups or white nationalist groups, white supremacist groups.
This is something that's getting confused a lot. Are you seeing in your reporting on the ground that Antifa or far left groups are also contributing to some of the chaos that's there, and somehow connecting that, to what's happening with more peaceful protests?
One of the things that we are seeing is troubling is that far right extremists are posing as leftists, including Antifa, online to spread disinformation and incite violence. And, you know, this was something that Site Intel, which monitors extremist activity online, warned about last week. And then yesterday, NBC published a story showing that a white supremacist group that was in Charlottesville had, you know, created a fake account posing as Antifa, encouraging violence in residential areas.
Now, I guess what I'm at, I'd love to know, Tess, you know, when we look at the response that President Trump, for example, had to Charlottesville, when he described very fine people on both sides, and we compare that to what we're seeing just this week, how do you interpret that?
I mean, invoking Antifa is a political tool. We've seen it used before. We saw it used then. We're seeing it, you know, last year, Ted Cruz introduced a bill to try and get Antifa labeled as a domestic terror group. And so now we're seeing it again. But I think it's also, you know, important to remember that the FBI has said repeatedly over the last year that the major concern for the Bureau was white supremacist or racially motivated violent extremists, is what they call, who are accounting for the majority of their domestic terror investigations.
Leisha, we've got about a minute left in the segment. Just want to ask you quickly, what do attempts from public officials, as we heard, and from the president to place blame on outside groups actually do to the overall message of the protests?
What I would say is that we need to readjust our focus back to the protests. What are the protests about? The protests are about the systemic nature of racism and anti-Black racism in particular in this country. So anything that doesn't speak to that is a distraction. And I would encourage the president to address the very real issues that are present instead of creating kind of a political distraction with Antifa.
Well, we'll be watching to see what the president does next. Tess Owen is a reporter for Vice News who covers extremism. Hello. And Leisha Brooks is the outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
And as we just heard, there are growing concerns about the role of extremists in the uprisings against police brutality across the United States. And while we're still learning more on that, we're getting a much better sense for what extremism looks like in our electoral politics. On May 19th, Joe Ray Perkins won the Republican primary race for U.S. Senate in Oregon with nearly 50% of the vote. Perkins is an avowed supporter of the far-right QAnon conspiracy theory. QAnon supporters like Perkins believe there's a secret plot against President Trump by the quote-unquote deep state.
I think that there's probably a lot of us out there. I just happen to be bold enough to say, hey, I'm following Q because I want to know, because if the Q team is real, I want to know about it.
Perkins is not the only one. Almost 50 QAnon supporters ran for Congress in 2020, and at least 6 will be candidates in November's general election. Will Summer is a tech and internet reporter for The Daily Beast, and he's been following QAnon for several years now.
QAnon is sort of a mega conspiracy theory that wraps in a lot of earlier conspiracy theories we've dealt with. It's based on a series of anonymous clues that have been posted by this person named Q, who claims to be in the Trump administration on various internet message boards. And basically, to sum up the message of Q, it's essentially that Donald Trump is engaged in this sort of secret war against top Democrats and this kind of global cabal of elites, which QAnon believers think essentially are kind of like cannibal pedophiles. I mean, they're almost like satanic figures.
Now, does this go back to the Pizzagate scandal?
Yeah, I mean, really an easy way to think about QAnon is to sort of think of it as Pizzagate 2 or like mega Pizzagate. Because, as you say, a lot of the things in QAnon, I think we saw initially with Pizzagate, this idea that Hillary Clinton was, you know, had a torture dungeon for children, stuff like that. But really, we've seen QAnon becomes sort of an all-encompassing conspiracy theory that can really suck in new current events.
So it's a theory. It's not a group per se.
Well, I would say at this point it is a movement. I mean, it's sort of based on this idea that, you know, this is a way of seeing the world. It's become such more of a broader group that really sucks in everything from, you know, religious groups to just really like hardcore Trump supporters to people with even crazier ideas. So at this point, I would say it is a movement. I mean, you look at the Trump rallies back when they still had them. You know, we saw all these people with Q signs, stuff like that.
Well, who's Jo Ray Perkins and how did she win this primary?
So Jo Ray Perkins is now the Republican Senate nominee in Oregon. And she won, I believe, last week. And she's notable because she's a hardcore QAnon believer. And so this is sort of the highest, you know, as far as I know, the highest political rank we've seen one of these people achieve.
Was this a fluke? I mean, was this a question of people, as we know, when it comes to voting in elections other than the presidential election, there tend to be low turnout. So was this a fluke? Was this a question of people not turning out? Or were people pretty aware of who this Jo Ray Perkins was and wanted her to win this nomination?
Sure. So obviously, Oregon is a Democratic state. And so, you know, whoever the Republican nominee is going to be in November in that state is going to end up being, you know, kind of facing an uphill battle. On the other hand, though, you know, Jo Ray Perkins won this nomination pretty handily by like 20 points over her next Republican rival. And so this is not just like no one turned out. I mean, I think this is, you know, certainly she had a lot of support from QAnon believers across the country who were donating to her. They said, you know, she's up against this deep state money, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, and certainly QAnon people have seen her primary win as a real validation.
How forthcoming has she been about her support for QAnon? It's sort of gone, she's sort of gone back and forth, right, with how transparent she is about that?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So back in January, Jo Ray Perkins gave this interview to an outfit called Right Wing Watch, where she said, yeah, I'm really into QAnon. And she basically said that being really open about her beliefs, voters would hate it or they'd love it. And obviously, the primary voters, we saw what they made of it. And then, you know, she's really like an open promoter of it. She goes on QAnon YouTube shows. And after her victory, she made this video that said, and it really sort of a bizarre thing to see for, you know, a candidate with the backing of a major political party. She said, you know, thanks to Q and the whole QAnon gang for powering my victory. And then a couple days later, she gets some media attention and her campaign says, oh, like, what are you talking about? She's not into QAnon, even though, you know, there's this video and plenty of others. And then in an interview, she says, oh, you know, ignore my campaign statement. I love QAnon. She's described as like being near tears. She says something along the lines of like QAnon is essentially a religious issue for her.
Well, we looked at there was a piece in Vox that said that Perkins is one of at least seven GOP congressional candidates who've publicly supported the QAnon ideology. How much sway does this ideology currently have in today's Republican Party? I mean, is anybody speaking out against this or is this sort of a growing trend that you're seeing in the party?
It certainly is a growing trend in the party. You know, it's difficult to get numbers. I would estimate that at least, you know, something like 15% of Republicans have a positive view of QAnon, which, of course, is not a majority of the party. But when you kind of get into, you know, that's still a huge number of people. And of course, there's different variations of kind of affiliation with QAnon. Like some people are really into it and they spend all their time researching it and they alienate their family members. On the other hand, you know, there's some people who just sort of see it as meaning you're really into Trump. And so that's how they see it. But yeah, I mean, these are not just a couple crazy people online. I mean, we've seen Donald Trump has retweeted QAnon supporters a lot, including tweets that include like QAnon hashtags. He's invited QAnon supporters to the White House. So, you know, these are not necessarily, you know, just kind of really like a rootless group. I mean, I do think they are making inroads in the GOP. Notably, the Republican Senate committee did not disown Jo Ray Perkins, and they said, well, we'll probably support her because she's a Republican Senate candidate. So, you know, I think there's kind of this dance that the GOP does where they don't quite want to say, you know, QAnon's true because, you know, that's going to alienate a lot of regular people. But on the other hand, they've been really unwilling to disavow QAnon.
Is the GOP, I mean, this is a broader question, but whether or not the GOP is really concerned about alienating a lot of folks is, I think, is something that, that is worth further exploration at this point. You mentioned the president has retweeted QAnon accounts. He's invited QAnon supporters to the White House. There are a number of congressional candidates who publicly support QAnon, and yet this ideology and people who support it, several folks have been involved in real-life acts of violence. I'm wondering, how does this administration or beyond, how do they reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's been honestly kind of shocking to me to see, as QAnon becomes more violent, that the president has, you know, continued to kind of flirt with it. You know, we've seen there's two murder charges that appear to be motivated by QAnon. There was a terrorist incident near the Hoover Dam. There have been two child kidnapping plots. So the FBI considers QAnon a source of potential domestic terror, and yet we have, you know, them getting invited to the White House. So there's a real disconnect there.
And Will, to that point, I mean, the fact that the FBI has made it clear that domestic terror incidences are on the rise in this country, and it's something that they consider a focal point, at least moving forward, reconciling what intelligence agencies in the United States are saying about this ideology versus what the GOP is doing seems, and the GOP and our president, who seemingly is on the side of law enforcement, I'm having trouble putting that together. I mean, how does an ideology and supporters of that ideology end up in the White House with or even beyond in the Senate when there are concerns about potential domestic terror disputes?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of incoherence there. I mean, I think the White House just kind of sees perhaps these people as real, like, hardcore Trump fans. And, you know, I mean, it's QAnon people basically believe they sort of see Trump as like a messianic figure, not just a great president or a great politician, but they see him as like, you know, this kind of seminal historical and even religious figure. And so, you know, the White House has not really stepped out to disavow them of that idea.
And just to be clear, does QAnon so far have any explicit ties to white nationalism, or is that something that is still being explored right now?
So right now, I mean, for the most part, kind of the mainline QAnon, if you could, you know, it sounds silly to talk about it like that, but sort of the mainstream QAnon is not explicitly white nationalist. But on the other hand, they do draw on some of the same sort of mythologies and the same tropes as anti-Semitic groups. You know, QAnon people, for one thing, are obsessed with George Soros, the Jewish billionaire who supports Democrats. They're generally just very fascinated by the idea that, you know, kind of this cabal of, you know, wealthy people, you know, mostly, you know, who they particularly focus on Jewish people, that they control the world. And of course, the tropes they have about, you know, Democrats like eating children or sucking their blood, I mean, recalls, you know, anti-Semitic blood libel tropes.
Well, we're going to be paying a lot of attention to this as it increasingly influences our national political discourse. Will Sommer is a tech and internet reporter for The Daily Beast. Will, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In 2018, Floridians voted in favor of restoring the right to vote for millions of formerly incarcerated felons. But by mid-2019, Republican Governor Rick DeSantis and the Republican-led state legislature passed a law prohibiting former felons from voting until they paid off any outstanding fines and fees connected to their case. A confusing payment system combined with the financial hardships that many face meant that the majority of felons in Florida wouldn't be able to pay these fines and would never have their voting rights restored. Last month, however, a federal judge ruled that law unconstitutional and in violation of the 24th Amendment, calling it a, quote, pay-to-vote system. Sean Morales Doyle is a senior counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he was one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the trial challenging the law.
The 24th Amendment, which prohibited poll taxes, actually said you can't make voting contingent on paying a poll tax or other tax. The folks that wrote the 24th Amendment knew that maybe states would try to be creative about how they would put a price tag on voting. And that's what Florida did. So this wasn't exactly a poll tax, but it was requiring people to pay taxes to vote. And the judge said that violates the 24th Amendment.
According to Sean, about nearly 800,000 people formerly charged with felonies in Florida will now get their voting rights restored.
In terms of race, this policy of felony disenfranchisement in Florida and across the country disproportionately impacts people of color. In Florida, the impact on Black Floridians was really stunning. Prior to the passage of Amendment 4, it was estimated that one out of every five Black voting age adults in Florida was disenfranchised as a result of a conviction in their past. The data that our expert got together showed that not only is felony disenfranchisement something that disproportionately impacts Black Floridians, but that this requirement of paying to vote disproportionately impacts them, that the vast majority of people who have a conviction owe some money because the Florida criminal justice system just heaps debt on people. But Black Floridians are more likely to owe money and more likely to owe more money than their white counterparts. But the majority of people with felony convictions in Florida are white. It is a population that is disproportionately Black compared to the general population. But actually, the majority of people with felony convictions in Florida are white. And so it's also important to think about this not in terms of race, but in as you point out, in terms of income, in terms of wealth. And the claim that we won on back in the fall and that we won again on after this trial, one of the claims was that this is unconstitutional wealth discrimination. Obviously, people who go through the criminal justice system, the economic realities that they face are pretty dire. It's hard to get a job. And most of them go into the criminal justice system already in a bad spot when it comes to money.
Well, so I'm curious whether the judge acknowledged that disparity, the racial and economic disparities in his decision. And we're talking about Judge Robert Hinkle here, who decided the case, who's at the U.S. District Court in Tallahassee.
Yes, he did acknowledge it. One of our claims was that this was actually a form of race discrimination. And the judge held that this law wasn't passed with the intent to discriminate against Black Floridians, although he said that was a close call. But in ruling on that claim, he acknowledged the disproportionate impact that it has on Black Floridians. And of course, ruling on the wealth discrimination claim, he made very clear that he thinks that it's unconstitutional to deny someone the right to vote because they're too poor to afford it. And he has acknowledged this disparity in the past as well. There's no doubt that Florida's legislature knew when they passed this law that they were passing a law that was going to disproportionately impact Black Floridians. That was made clear to them. Our client, the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, and many, many others were sounding the alarm about the impact this would have on the Black community in Florida. And they went ahead and passed the law anyway, knowing the impact that it would have. And the judge said it was a close call whether they did that intentionally to discriminate against Black Floridians, ultimately decided that it wasn't, that we hadn't proven that it was intentional. But there's no doubt that everyone knew and the impact that it was going to have and that it has, in fact, had that impact.
Sean, given the fact that this has gone back and forth and the community that we're talking about here has probably gotten a lot of mixed messages, and now, of course, we're dealing with a global pandemic, which is affecting, among other things, our ability to get out to the polls and to vote. How are former felons who now have the ability to vote, what is it that they can do to make sure that they're taking advantage of that opportunity, given the coronavirus crisis that we're facing right now, among other things?
Yeah, it's a great question. Florida, thankfully, in some respects, Florida elections are more prepared for this pandemic than some other states. Florida already allows anybody to vote by mail, and Florida already has a system of online voter registration. So folks can start getting registered now. They can do it from home, and they can vote from home as well. And so hopefully, in that respect, Florida has made this a little bit easier on people. To your point, it really has been shameful how the state, in addition to passing this law that disenfranchised so many people, also just made it impossible for people to know whether they were eligible or not. They just failed to provide any guidance whatsoever. And as the judge described it, this was an administrative train wreck, this law. They didn't just put a price tag on voting. They made it so people can't even figure out what the price is. In Florida, it's impossible to figure out what you owe. And so the judge's opinion, I would say he did two things. One of them was make sure that everyone got their rights restored. But just as important was that he provided a way for people to know whether they're eligible and to get registered. And he gave clarity to people and said that these financial obligations don't count against you. If you're unable to afford them, you can get registered now. And if you don't know what you owe and can't figure out whether you're unable to afford them, he provided a process for asking the state for an opinion on that. And if you don't get an answer in 3 weeks, you can get registered. So he's cleared the way for people to start getting registered. And thankfully, Florida's got the mechanisms in place for people to do that and to get voting without having to risk their health.
Sean, I want to ask you before, as we're wrapping up here, I want to ask you a little bit about the likelihood that this population will vote. And if they do turn out to vote, you mentioned the former felon population in Florida is up in the hundreds of thousands of people who've now essentially been given the green light to vote. How likely is it that this population will vote in 2020? And if they do turn out to the polls, what effect could that have, given that Florida, as we know, is a critical state, particularly in a presidential election?
Amendment 4 was such a thrilling moment for so many people in Florida, and it impacts such an enormous percentage of Florida's population that I think there was a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about getting people engaged and getting people voting. And I think that this law put somewhat of a damper on that and slowed that down. But with this ruling, I'm hopeful that that enthusiasm and excitement will pick back up and a lot of people will get engaged. In terms of the impact that it could have, I mean, it could be a huge impact on the election. But the impact, I think, is that it's making this election look more like what Floridians wanted it to look like. As I said, 64.5% of Floridians' voters said they wanted to expand democracy. They wanted to welcome this million plus people back into the conversation. That's what they want their elections to look like. And that's a huge impact, no matter which way these new voters vote. And I think what's a shame is how much the legislature and others seem to be thinking about how they think these voters are going to vote when they make decisions about who has the right to vote. And none of us should be deciding who can vote and who can't based on whether we think they're going to side with us when they go to the polls. However, in the election plays out, at least now we can say that it accurately reflected what Florida's eligible adult citizens wanted the outcome to look like.
Well, as you said, the majority of Floridians did vote for this. Sean Morales Doyle is senior counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice and was one of the lawyers representing the plaintiffs in the recent trial challenging the Florida fine law. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're continuing our conversation about felon voting rights in Florida. Eugene Williams was released from prison in 2011 after serving 18 years in Florida's Department of Corrections for armed robbery. In 2018, when Florida voters passed Amendment 4, it looked like Eugene would finally have his voting rights restored until a new state law was passed requiring former felons to pay off all fines related to their case in order to register to vote. For Eugene and hundreds of thousands of others with hefty outstanding fines, this meant that he would remain disenfranchised, possibly for the rest of his life. That all changed last week after a federal judge ruled that the new law preventing Eugene from voting violates the 24th Amendment. And now, after nearly three decades, Eugene will finally have his voting rights restored and will be able to vote in the November election. Eugene now works for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, where he advocates for the rights of formerly incarcerated individuals. Eugene, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
I appreciate it. It's an honor to be here, ma'am.
So you were in prison for 18 years.
Yes, ma'am.
You became involved in the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. For what purpose? I mean, had you tried voting in the past and were unable to?
It's always been my passion to get into somewhat politics. And about a year, I think I got out of prison. I became passionate about, you know, the disenfranchised, you know, because we are so at disadvantage. And FRRC has been a godsend entity. These people have opened doors that we never thought would be open. And I'm grateful to them. I'm very grateful.
Are you going to vote in the election, given the news?
I definitely am, because this is a big win for us. Our voice can be heard, too. Definitely, I'm going to vote. I'm going to make my voice heard, and I'm going to use that platform to advocate to the rest of my disenfranchised brothers and sisters.
Is the population that we're talking about going to turn out to vote? Do you know people who have been waiting and watching this news unfold? who have been formerly incarcerated who are now planning to vote? Or has this dissuaded them from going out to the polls because of the back and forth?
I believe that a lot of the disenfranchised out there are uneducated as to what's going on or what has happened in the judicial system, the court system. I think that they don't really know. So I felt like that was my responsibility to kind of advocate, hey, you know, this thing is so easy to get done. You know, all you have to do is make some initiative to get it done. So I can't really say how many out there, but I know there's millions like me. Millions. And I just took the initiative to make it happen. And now that it's happening for me, I want to go out and push these other people out here to get up and go out there and make your voice heard.
The initial law would have required incarcerated or formerly incarcerated people like you to pay fines before voting. How hard would that have made it for you to vote?
There was no way in the world I can pay close to $3,000. I wouldn't have been able to vote. And FRRC stepped in and they made this possible for me, you know, and like I tell everybody else, these people will make it possible for you as well if you just take the initiative. So, no, I wouldn't have been able to vote. My voice would still be silent.
What continues to give you faith in the democratic process that in the democratic process in general?
You know, I've seen racism up close and personal. I had some white guys out there calling me monkeys. It was scary. It was really scary. And I think that's what kind of fueled me even more because I had never dealt with that situation before. And when I did deal with it, it was like a life changing situation. It gives me so much drive because, again, the only way we're going to effect change is to get out and vote. Get out and vote. This pay to vote situation Mr. DeSantis got going or had going on, it was like he was suppressing us. I am a living witness that people can be rehabilitated. And I think that it would be more purposeful if they would just get on board and start granting us these rights to vote because it gives us purpose. When you take that purpose away from us, stuff like last week, that's what happens.
Florida is obviously a swing state. Do you think that if the formerly incarcerated in Florida, formerly incarcerated Floridians who now have finally, at least right now, have the right to vote, do you think that's going to change anything about Florida?
I kind of think that they have Mr. DeSantis, Trump, they have a fear of that, you know, that the disenfranchised, you know, we'll come together. We'll remember the suppression that they offered us to stay down when we tried to come up. And I think our voices will make a great impact in this election. And as I told you earlier, I plan on being there to make my voice heard. No matter what, my head can be falling off, I'm going to be there to make my voice heard. And I'm going to use that as a platform to advocate to my other disenfranchised brothers and sisters as well. So, yeah, I definitely think that will make a huge difference.
Eugene, one last thing. I asked you, you said you've written to Governor DeSantis multiple times, and I asked you if you could say something to him, what would you say? We don't know if Governor DeSantis listens to this show, but I'm sure that there are people out there who have been in touch with the criminal justice system, who have had contact with it, who perhaps themselves are formerly incarcerated. What would you say to them about voting this election?
It's important. It's important.
Just provided they're able to, of course.
Just look at what's going on. It is important. And last night, I see people on TV saying that, oh, this is a shame. This shouldn't be happening. Give us a voice to help change what's going on in the world. You know, like I just said, we're not all bad people. We make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Mr. DeSantis, Trump, all of them, they probably made mistakes, just never got caught. Okay, I was unfortunate to get caught making my mistake. But America is based on second chances. And I think that it would be so purposeful and meaningful to offer that second chance because things would change then. Things would change. Recidivism rate goes down. And you offer us purpose in life. Don't keep us oppressed and, you know, just keep us down in the gutters because if that's what happens, recidivism rate goes up. But I tell people all the time, just remember, no matter what we are disenfranchised, we're still your neighbors. We're the guy that's sitting on the corner at the corner store. We're still there. So why not offer some incentive to make us more productive in life instead of keeping us oppressed? We're based on second chances. I love FRRC. They've opened these doors for me, and I love them to death. As a matter of fact, on tomorrow, I go, my voting rights have pretty much been restored. I went through the process with FRRC, and on tomorrow at 3 o'clock, I actually go in front of the judge to make this official. And this is like the happiest day of my life, because my voice has been silent for so long. Now, I'm going to use that voice for something really meaningful and purposeful. So tomorrow will be an awesome day for me.
Eugene, I want to wish you a wonderful day tomorrow as you stand in front of a judge to have your right to vote reinstated in the state of Florida. Best of luck to you, and we'll see how things turn out in Florida. Eugene Williams works at the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Eugene, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're back with The Takeaway. And as uprisings spread across the United States, white people are trying to figure out their role in the fight against police brutality and racism. Tim Wise has been thinking a lot about what it means to be an ally in this moment. Tim is an anti-racism educator and author of several books, including White Like Me and the forthcoming Dispatches from the Race War. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things I think it's important to have this conversation is because often when we talk about race and racism, it's people of color, it's black people, it's Latinos, it's Asians being called to explain and express the issues that they're facing. What is the role of white people right now in this conversation?
Well, I think first it's important to note that it should be, I think, black and brown folks, people of color, who are leading this conversation, because, you know, they are the ones who are principally affected by police misconduct and certainly by institutional racism. And so I think that's perfectly appropriate. Having said that, I do think there's a role for white folks to play, as there always has been, within the anti-racism and equal justice struggle in this country. That role, I think, is to act in solidarity with those persons of color affected by institutional racism. And that means following their lead and really listening to them. White folks have never really been taught or trained to listen to black folks and brown folks when they talk about their reality, and then to believe that those persons of color actually know what they're talking about. We're so quick to dismiss their concerns. You have Robert O'Brien, the national security advisor, you know, saying he doesn't believe there's systemic racism in policing.
No, I don't think there's systemic racism. I think 99.9% of our law enforcement officers are great Americans, and many of them are African-American, Hispanic, Asian. They're working in the toughest neighborhoods. They've got the hardest jobs to do in this country. And I think they're amazing, great Americans, and they're my heroes.
Aside from the fact that we can actually prove it pretty easily quantitatively as a problem, for him to say that, and for I think most white Americans to believe that, is to dismiss the lived reality of black Americans. That is an incredibly arrogant thing and really sort of underlying sort of racist thing to do. And so I think white Americans' role is to learn to listen, learn to believe, learn to trust that black and brown peoples know their reality better than you do, and then figure out how you are going to leverage your influence, your power, your privilege, even if it's just within your neighborhood, your community, or your family, to engage in these kind of conversations about the kind of country that we want to be as opposed to the kind of country that we are right now.
So, Tim, I totally get that point. I think there's also, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, another piece of this, which is talking about race and racism in the United States is often considered exclusively a conversation about people of color, about black people in this country, yeah. and that we're the ones that are supposed to have it. We're the ones that have the history of it. White Americans, in many instances, don't even understand the role that they have in creating racism. And when I say that, I mean it on many ends of the scale, right? There's a scale of racist events and actions, if you can. There's implicit racism, there's explicit. But I just feel like there's a disconnect between the role that white Americans genuinely feel that they play in perpetrating and sustaining racism.
Right. Well, first off, we should just be more precise in all of our language, right? What we're dealing with is not racism, it's white supremacy. That's the particular kind of racism that we have in this country. It doesn't mean that it's the only kind that could ever exist on the planet, but it's certainly the operative kind that exists in this country, in this culture. And it was created hundreds of years ago. Obviously, no one alive is responsible for having created it, but we inherit the legacy of that. And as a result, all of us end up in this society being implicated in it in some way. Number one, we internalize the biases that are handed down throughout the culture. By the way, not only white folks do that, black and brown folks internalize biases against themselves and against other people of color. And secondly, we take part in institutions that were established for the purpose of maintaining or perpetuating inequality. So whether we're talking about the labor market, whether we're talking about law enforcement, whether we're talking about the educational system, all of these structures were created on the premise of white domination.
This type of ignorance, it just seems foundational to American history. How much does the lack of education about this issue in our academic system have anything to do with this?
Well, that certainly contributes to it. We are a country that has elevated historical amnesia to the level of a religious sacrament. And so there's a combination of, you know, the things that were never really taught or the things that were taught, but then we selectively choose to forget. But I think there's even something more foundational than that. If you live in a society that elevates you on the basis of your skin color and says that whoever is at the top of the society deserves to be there because, after all, we're a nation of meritocracy and rugged individualism and anybody can make it if they try, right? That's our foundational mythos. That's our secular gospel. If you tell people that, if you say wherever you end up is all about your own effort, and then you end up with a profoundly unequal system because of those structures that you've just alluded to, it can't be very surprising, can it, that all throughout your history, you're going to have people who rationalize the inequality that they see because they were led to believe that wherever people end up is all about them. And we have believed that. That is our secular gospel. It's Genesis 1:1 in the Bible of Americanism. And so until we challenge that mentality that was constructed alongside a systemic and institutional structure of deliberate inequality, we're never going to get at the root of this thing because we're going to keep blaming the victims of racism for their experience of it.
We are obviously watching this uprising unfold across the United States. It is one of the most visible displays of black pain in the United States that I've ever seen. And that's after covering Ferguson and watching these uprisings happen across the country. White Americans are protesting in these movements. What is their role, Tim? What is it that is expected at this point of white Americans who want to engage in these events?
Well, I hope that the white folks who are joining because they understand the importance of black and brown led struggle, and they want to be part of that in terms of real solidarity. The way that white abolitionists were, the way that white folks in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and others in the civil rights struggle were. I worry that some just sort of see this as this historic moment that they want to be a part of, and they don't really connect necessarily to the pain that you're talking about. I hope I'm wrong about that. I think there's a lot of goodwill and a lot of really good intention. The problem is, of course, white good intentions sometimes can get in the way of real movement strategy. I think one of the things that's really important right now, you have groups like Surge that works directly with Black Lives Matter chapters around the country and other black and brown-led organizations around racial justice. And Surge is encouraging white folks to show up, but to do so in a way that supports the leadership of black and brown folks in this struggle. That, you know, in the case of these demonstrations, they've been telling white folks, look, come and form a perimeter around black folks to protect them from police, because we know that given the chance, police are going to be more brutal towards black protesters than they are white protesters. We saw that in Ferguson. We've seen that in Baltimore. We've seen that around the country. So it is about going and working as soldiers for social justice under the leadership and direction of black folks who run this movement. That, I think, is the role of white folks. It is to show up, hold the sign, stare down the officers who really, frankly, in many cases, want to tear gas you and may very well do so, and demonstrate that you believe in a different and a new America than the one that we have right now.
Tim Wise is an anti-racism educator and the author of several books, including the forthcoming Dispatches from the Race War. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
And we'll be continuing our conversations about the role of white people in anti-racism work in the coming days. If you have thoughts or questions, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.